Well, good morning, everyone. Am I on?
No.
No. Testing? On? Yep. There we go. Good morning, everyone. Ah, oh. Ezra, Zaria, thank you for welcoming us into worship so well again this morning. Man, Jake, what a lovely prayer. Thank you for sharing that with us. Well done. And thanks, worship team, for guiding us in song today. During our class time, we talked a little bit about practicing a cruciform, cross-shaped piece. And during our time of sermon, I'd like to share with you an example of that. So I'm going to share a story with you today. And as with the gospel passage we just received, it's a very familiar story. Many of you have heard it before. And like Matthew 4... you're going to know how it ends long before we get to the conclusion of it. But I want to share it with you nonetheless one more time for this reason. Today is the final Sunday of February, which happens to be Black History Month. And today is the first Sunday of Lent. And this story that I'd like to share with you today is the best story I know that fits that sort of cosmic conjunction we have today, Black History Month, first Sunday of Lent. So, we're told in our gospel reading this morning that Jesus went into the wilderness because the Spirit led him there. But the question is, why, once he arrived there, did Jesus choose to stay there? Why suffer in such a barren place? That's the question I hope today's story can help us answer. So, the familiar story. In 1958, during what was known as the doctor's draft, a 29-year-old psychiatrist from Harvard was commissioned into the United States Air Force. The commission sent him to Keesler's Air Force Base in Biloxi, Mississippi, where he served as chief of neuropsychiatric services at the military hospital. During his service in Biloxi, the young psychiatrist made frequent trips to one of the South's most famed cities, New Orleans, Louisiana, just 90 minutes away. As you know, the late 50s, early 60s was a time of deep social unrest in the South, to say the least. Laws were changing. Culture was changing. Life was changing. And New Orleans was experiencing a rather volatile moment in its storied history. And on one such trip to the Big Easy, while headed to a doctor's appointment of his own, the Air Force psychiatrist noticed a large crowd outside a three-story gray stone building on the corner of Galvez and Pauline Streets. And he noticed there a mob of malcontents shouting and pacing. The odd thing being, they were the only ones around. This mob was the only one around. It wasn't at all obvious to the psychiatrist whom they were shouting at or even why they were there in the first place. Perplexed and intrigued, he got out to see what was happening. Approaching the crowd, the psychiatrist asked one of the members of the mob, "What's going on?" and received a one-sentence answer, "She's coming out in half an hour." Since this didn't clarify a thing for him, he pressed further. "Who's she?" The man from the mob looked incredulous. And then the psychiatrist writes, "I heard the abrasive vitriol about who she was, all the foul language included." And at 2:30 that afternoon, chaos erupted. Now, it is not overstating the facts to say that what this mental health professional witnessed that day changed his life forever. Indeed, he would himself later say he never really understood Jesus until he witnessed a contemporary Christ in the form of a six-year-old child at the center of that afternoon's maelstrom. And Jesus, led by the Spirit, went into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. In 1954, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in a now famous case known as Brown versus Board of Education that state laws establishing segregation in public schools are, in fact, unconstitutional. And because of this, the ruling required that public schools nationwide cease their segregation within 6 years' time. Reluctant to comply, yet under heavy pressure from the federal government, the school board of the Orleans Parish eventually determined to allow integration if black students were first able to pass an entrance exam. In 1960, exactly 6 years after the Supreme Court ruling, the first exam was administered, and six black children from New Orleans passed, permitting them to enroll in the all-white William T. France Elementary at the corner of Galvez and Pauline Streets. Six children passed, but only one would attend. Led by the Spirit of God, she walked straight into the wilderness to face the devil. And while Jesus was in the desert, he fasted 40 days and 40 nights, and afterwards, he was famished. That Air Force psychiatrist, if you don't recall or don't already know, is Dr. Robert Coles. The event he witnessed that fall afternoon was a young black girl coming out of France Elementary in New Orleans, flanked before, behind, and on either side by U.S. Marshals. And what he witnessed that day was a malicious horde unleashing a frightening verbal onslaught upon that girl, brandishing their fists, shouting their hate, threatening death. One woman promised to poison her, while another carried a coffin with a black doll inside it. The little girl, of course, was Ruby Bridges. In preparation for that infamous day, the school vociferously voiced their protests, and only one teacher, Miss Barbara Henry of Boston, Massachusetts, was willing to accept Ruby into her room. Not a single white student showed up for class while she was there. Ruby was a class of one. She ate lunch alone, played at recess alone, learned arithmetic alone, and yet never once missed a day of school that entire year. And the Bridges family suffered terribly. Her father lost his job at the gas station. Grocery stores refused to sell to her mother. And Ruby's sharecropping grandparents were evicted from their farm where they had lived and worked for a quarter century. The wilderness was barren and provided no sustenance. And afterwards, she was famished. And then the tempter came to Jesus. One day, after building a relationship with Ruby, her family, her school, Robert Coles heard that Ruby had been talking to the crowds, that mass of humanity out there every morning and every afternoon, waiting for her, taunting her, screaming at her. When Coles asked Ruby what she was saying to them, Ruby replied, "Oh yes, I told my teacher I wasn't talking to them," which initially relieved Coles, until Ruby continued, "I wasn't talking to them, I was just saying a prayer for them." Coles confesses he was so startled by her response, he actually thought he had misheard what she was saying. "You pray for them?" he asked. "Oh yes," Ruby said again. And all he could think to offer in reply was, "For God's sake, why, Ruby?" Ruby's mom, who overheard that conversation, told Coles that Ruby actually kept these people on a list and then prayed for them every night. Coles was, he reports, dumbfounded. He admitted years later that his initial response was to tell Ruby's family it was the wrong thing to do. Those crowds did not deserve her prayers. It was giving too much, going too far. To which, he writes, Ruby's family simply looked at him, dumbfounded in return. And eventually, Ruby's mother replied, "Well, don't you think they need praying for?" Ruby, the tempter declared, "Wouldn't you rather curse those crowds? Hate, after all, only understands hate. Scripture itself says, an eye for an eye. Their hostility does not deserve your love." But Jesus answered him and said, "It is written." A couple weeks later, Coles brought the prayers up once again. "Ruby," he said, "I'm still puzzled. I'm just trying to figure out why you think you should be the one to pray for such people." Ruby stared back at Coles and said, without a touch of irony, "Well, shouldn't it especially be me?" Bear in mind, this girl's a first grader. And then Ruby proceeded to tell Coles what she had heard in church. The minister, she reported, said that Jesus went through a lot of trouble and was sorely tested and tempted. And in response to those who caused him all that trouble, Jesus prayed, "Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing." And so, Ruby asked, "Shouldn't I do the same?" Coles found himself silenced in the presence of a 6-year-old child. "How is someone like me," Coles later reflected, "supposed to account for what Ruby did?" There's Ruby, who had taken no courses in moral analysis or systematic ethics, had read no books on the subject, indeed was just learning how to read. And yet somehow, this child found the grace to walk through that mob praying for those people. And for the first time in his life, Coles realized he had seen Christ. And Satan left Jesus. And suddenly, angels came and tended to him. When Ruby Bridges entered France Elementary, the white parents pulled their children out immediately. But on Ruby's second day, witnessing the courage of this young girl, a 34-year-old Methodist minister, a white man named Lloyd Foreman, broke the boycott line with his 5-year-old daughter, Pamela. And as that crowd turned their murderous threats towards Foreman and his daughter, they walked up the steps of that school and stood beside Ruby. Side note, in 2010, 50 years after Ruby's famous walk in the wilderness on the corner of Galvez and Pauline streets, Ruby and Pamela Foreman stood together once again at a reunion on the steps of France Elementary, in memorial of Ruby's courage. And then, a few days later, after the foreman walked those steps, other white parents began bringing their children as well, in solidarity with Ruby and in rejection of that crazed mob. And they were not alone. Others around town, both black and white, began to step in and step up. One neighbor provided Ruby's father a new job. Others babysat Ruby's siblings so her mother could walk with Ruby to school and so that her parents could work. Others sent money to cover rent and food. Several families formed an unofficial brigade who took it upon themselves to stand watch at the Bridges house so they'd be safe. And still others marched every morning beside Ruby and the federal marshals as she made her way to school. Ruby reports that it was not until she was an adult that she learned that those immaculate clothes she wore to school every day, the dresses, socks, and shoes she's wearing, and all those memorable pictures we've seen, were sent to her by a relative of Robert Cole's. Ruby says her family could not have afforded such things, but man, she loved wearing them. This community, Ruby later declared, had become for her ministering angels in her and her family's most difficult trial. So, why did Jesus stay in the desert? Why not simply leave and avoid the suffering altogether? Because Jesus, like Ruby Bridges after him, believed that life, true life, is found not when we run from the difficulties of the desert, but only as we walk through them in courage and trust and love. Ruby Bridges and the community that surrounded her believed they owed it to themselves, they owed it to God, and they owed it even to their enemies to refuse hate for hate and to choose instead the freedom of love. Such was the lesson of a 6-year-old girl in the wilderness of Louisiana who, like Jesus, chose to stay. You and I, of course, will never face a desert quite like Ruby's, but I suspect we'll have deserts of our own, temptations of our own, certainly sufferings of our own. And the promise of the gospel, the very hope of Lent, is that if we can find the courage and trust to face them, to persevere through them, to stay, not with hate, but hope and love, then we too just may find life on the other side, and perhaps even a few ministering angels of our own. Amen.